If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Welcome back to the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross. And once again, we turn to one of the great historical authors, Nathaniel Philbrick, who has written page-turners about history, including Bunker Hill, Valiant Ambition, Travels with George, and the book simply titled Mayflower, though that is really the only simple thing about it. Ned, it is good to have you on one of these holiday specials again, and we're going to fill in some blanks on the Mayflower story. I also want to get to an offshoot of that story, very important for our history, and sadly, little known to most Americans, which is King Philip's War. But first, you got into this story. How people get into stories always interests me. You got into the story because you moved to Nantucket, hitherto known as a lightship, a jumping off place for Moby Dick, and the subject of 1,000 limericks, not one of which I can repeat here.
Right. Well, it was coming to Nantucket in 1986. I was very happy to come because it was the port of the Pequod, which then led me into the history of Nantucket, which then led me into the history of New England, because I had to put Nantucket in some kind of perspective. And that's when I took up for the first time in a serious way William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation, which is the governor of Plymouth Colony's account of the year, his experiences with Plymouth Plantation. And it's one of the great books of the 17th century. I had grown up attending Thanksgiving pageants in elementary school, but this was a totally different take on what happened in Plymouth Colony. This was William Bradford talking about the pain, the loss, the ecstasy. It was all there.
And Bradford's an important part of the story, as we will find out as you and I talk here. But one of the things I find so striking, and of course, people did not live as long in those days, so people had to accomplish more and were expected to accomplish more early on. But Bradford, who is so important of this, along with many of the other people, including one of the captains, were teenagers.
Yeah. I mean, the youth of everyone is just amazing, I think, for the rest of us, particularly in my case, as we get much older. But it was a predominantly young group, they were heading to the adventure of their lives, or it could also be the catastrophe of their lives. It was, you know, a mystery, and they set off from England into the unknown.
Let's go back a little bit first. And just find out who these people are. What were the pilgrims all about? I mean, when they were in England, which they left, then to Holland, then to America, they had to meet in secret. Why?
Yeah, because what they were practicing was illegal in England. It was outside the Church of England. So they had to meet in secret, and they were basically outlaws, which is what forced them to go to Holland, which had a much more liberal attitude towards religious beliefs. But once in Holland, where they were for about a decade, they began to realize that their children were all becoming Dutch. And despite the fact that they were they were in Holland, they were still proudly English. So what to do? Well, go to the New World, as it was known, and where they could be English and practice their own religious beliefs.
They could also practice what they do. And I think one of the problems they had in Holland was essentially that they were farmers. They weren't city people. So they go to sea to the New World. But, you know, again, these are mostly farmers. They're not sailors. So are they even prepared to make that perilous a journey?
No, the people we think of as the pilgrims really had no idea what they were getting into and were not prepared for something like this. Few people were at that point, other than professional explorers, people like that. These were people driven by religious belief. They believed it was the will of God for them to seek a new place to practice their religion. A more pure form of religion from their standpoint, where they needed to have a one-on-one relationship with God. And so, yes, they were completely unprepared, didn't even have a map you could trust of the region where they ended up. It was a disaster in the making.
Yeah, I mean, they picked the wrong time of year. They had, at one point, a leaky ship. I mean, this really started out as if it was going to be an utter catastrophe.
Yeah, and particularly when they're finally goodbye to England, when they left Plymouth, the city of Plymouth. You know, as you said, it was the worst time of year to embark on a voyage to America. They would get there in late fall with winter coming on, the absolute worst time to try to create a new colony in an unknown world. And yet they felt this is what they were supposed to do. So off they went.
The trip over was miserable, and it was also filled with illness. And this may sound odd, in part because they ran out of beer.
Yes. Well, the drinking water was always unreliable, particularly if it was drinking water that had been taken from a city. And so beer was the way you got liquid that was not full of disease. And, you know, this was what the staff of life from their standpoint. But by the time they were approaching America, they were running out of beer. This was serious. And so they looked to the appearance of land with great expectation. Although, you know, where were they going to get beer in America?
Now, I should point out, and your book makes this really, really clear and goes into really great detail, as it does in so many things that even those of us who have studied this just didn't know. Not everybody on the Mayflower was a pilgrim, and this actually becomes important. Some were called strangers, and who were they?
Yeah, you know, I think if you were an Englishman, you would have regarded the strangers as the normal people, and the pilgrims would have been the aliens, because the strangers were people of, you know, Church of England people, normal lower class English people, out to get a better life. And while the pilgrims were united by their Puritan beliefs, and which were illegal in England. And so from the very beginning, you have on the Mayflower a divide, and I think a very American divide, where you have, you know, one group in one camp, another group in a different camp, and they do not see eye to eye. And so from the very beginning, there is division aboard the Mayflower that will manifest itself once they're on land and trying to create a community for the long term.
The need to get along with these strangers, with these non-pilgrims, and we should point out, people say, well, you know, they're Puritans and the other. Actually, the pilgrims were a tougher bunch than the Puritans. The pure Puritans who come later, who come with the permission of the Church of England and settle much of the rest of Massachusetts. So these are people really in bed with the king, as much as they still love England. But they need to get along with these strangers. And it's important they get along because the pilgrims want to start what is essentially a religious colony. This leads to the Mayflower Compact, which is a fascinating document.
It is. You know, the claims have made about it that are perhaps unjustified, but the fact is the circumstances under which this group of people who had just experienced a worst nightmare of a voyage were on the edge of on the coast of a land about which they knew nothing, were already beginning to become divided. Do they, you know, have a rebellion? No. They put pen to paper and craft the Mayflower Compact, in which they agree, both pilgrims and strangers, to follow the dictates of a civil society. And for the pilgrims, this was big because, you know, they were out to create their own theocracy. That's why they were making this voyage. But they realized that to make this thing work, to have any chance at survival at this late time of year in this unknown area, they needed to cooperate. And for that, they needed a document in which they agreed to live under civil law. And thus it begins.
We have more of the Thanksgiving Day special just ahead from CBS News Radio. Welcome back to the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross. We'll continue our conversation with Nathaniel Philbrick. Now, when the pilgrims arrive, there may be an irony here, but I need to know from you whether there is. The Native Americans, the Wampanoag natives who were there, knew about Europeans, knew about them for a century, because there had been Europeans who had come and had been offshore and come on shore, and there were stories about them and people taken into slavery and all of that. But did the pilgrims expect Native Americans? How much study and had the people on the Mayflower done about who they might meet, especially since they weren't at all where they expected to end up?
Yeah, they knew something of the Native peoples, but what they tended to focus on were the myths of the Native people, of cannibalism, of terrible violence. And so all their expectations were that, you know, they were going to be confronted with savages, when the irony here is that the Wampanoag knew much more, as you implied, knew much more about the English than the pilgrims knew about the native peoples. And the other factor was that for the 3 years preceding the arrival of the Mayflower, a series of European spawned epidemics had been ravaging the native peoples along the coast of what we call New England, reducing their populations by as much as by 80 to 90% with these terrible diseases for which they had no immunity. And so when the pilgrims arrive, it's a landscape that has changed radically in just the last 3 years due to these diseases. And it's in flux. It's just all sorts of things happening. And once again, the passengers on the Mayflower really have no clue as to what they're about to get themselves involved in.
Now, we mentioned Squanto in another segment of this special, but his story is worth telling because he is quite the guy, proficient in his native language, of course, proficient in English. And for anyone who thinks the Native Americans are just this, you know, simple people worshiping rainbows and unicorns, Squanto ends up playing both sides against one another and entirely for himself until it blows up in his face. What's his story, and how important a role is he in the story of the Mayflower and the story of that Plymouth colony?
Oh, Squanto is one of the more fascinating figures in the history of this country. He had been abducted by European explorers and ended up, after time in Spain, ended up in the streets of London, and where he learned English. And he would eventually go with another explorer back to America, eventually make his way from Nova Scotia down to New England. come to his hometown of Patuxent, which would become Plymouth, and found his village entirely empty of people. Everyone had either died or moved on in the midst of these terrible plagues. I mean, can you imagine what, you know, was going through his head? And he ended up basically a captive with Massasoit, who was the head of the Wampanoag, and their band was known as the Pokanokets within the Wampanoag. And Massasoit didn't entirely trust Squanto, and with good reason, because Squanto was the one person who knew both sides of it when it came to the Wampanoag's interactions with the English. He knew both languages, and that gave him tremendous power. You know, he could, he knew what both sides were saying, and he could, as the conduit between them, he could control the message that was being delivered on either side. And, you know, we're not, you know, completely clear on what Squanto's motivations were, but he was out for himself. He had seen how the Wampanoag had been ravaged by disease, were in danger of being taken over by their neighboring Narragansetts, who had not been troubled in the same way by disease. And he saw a political opportunity to make himself potentially the new leader. And so his interactions between the two, because Bradford would use Squanto as an interpreter and rely upon him, as it would only gradually unfold, they would realize that Squanto had an agenda of his own.
Yeah, I mean, Squanto at one point is telling the Native Americans to try and keep fear on both sides that the Pilgrims had barrels of plague that they could just unleash anytime they wished.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and so this was to strike fear into the Wampanoag that, and look, you know, I'm the one that can keep them from unleashing this. So do what, you know, they say, and particularly what I tell you they say. And so, yeah, and it took a while for the Pilgrims to realize, you know, that he was playing a game here. And it almost got to the point where Plymouth Plantation was lost in a war. But luckily, diplomacy reigned in one form or another, and they were to avoid that catastrophic violence that would have completely destroyed Plymouth Colony.
There is a lot going on here with the Wampanoags. It's one of the reasons for what we now celebrate as a Thanksgiving feast. The Wampanoags, because they've been wiped out by plague, being so subjected to attacks by the Narragansett that they're looking upon the Pilgrims as allies, even though they don't really trust them, because the last time Europeans show up, again, they took a lot of people as slaves. But one of the problems that the Wampanoags had with the Pilgrims after a while is that while Native Americans were dying of the plague and were reducing in numbers, how do I put this? The Pilgrims were making like bunnies.
Well, you know, the fertility rate is kind of extraordinary. I mean, there's John Howland, who by all rights should have drowned during the voyage. He fell off the Mayflower and was lucky enough to grab a line with which the sailors pulled him back. Well, he would live lead a long life, marry, and have something like more than 80 grandchildren by the time he died. And so, you know, this kind of birth rate, suddenly the Pilgrims are outgrowing their base in Plymouth. They're moving to Cape Cod and throughout, you know, south, what's now south of Boston, and moving on and taking land and pushing the native peoples aside as best they can. Well, the native peoples, the Wampanoag, are trading, you know, selling land, because initially it looks like there's plenty to share. But as the Pilgrims continue to grow exponentially, that's no longer the case by the second generation.
Yeah, it goes from, hey, this is a good military alliance and also, you know, good business deal. We've got trade, to all of a sudden, wait, they're everywhere and we're being pushed out of our homes. Just one or two more things about this part of the story because I want to get to King Philip's War. Because as I said at the beginning of our interview, it's something that's extremely important to American history that most Americans are completely and utterly unfamiliar with. But let's mention Miles Standish, the lovely figure on the Thanksgiving crockery, you know, that says what John Alden means and Priscilla just falls in love and all of that. Miles Standish was an unbelievably horrible man.
Well, he was their military officer. So they looked to him to be the strong guy. But yeah, he was, you know, at one point he led basically a guerrilla operation against the Massachusetts people in the Weymouth, currently the Weymouth, Massachusetts area, which they basically lure the leaders into a dinner and then attack them with knives and stab them to death and cut off the head of one of the warriors and bring it back to Plymouth Colony, where it is placed on a spike in front of the entrance to the fort as warning to all the native peoples. And this strikes fear into the native peoples throughout the region. You know, this is not how the original intention was. Their pastor, Reverend Robinson, back in Holland, had beseeched them to make friends with the native people. But with, you know, this was not that. This was ruling by the sword, but it would the way events would shake out, it would ultimately strengthen their alliance with the Wampanoag, with Massasoit. But it was, you know, when you look back in retrospect, it was a warning of things to come.
Stay here for more of the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. Happy Thanksgiving. This is the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio, and I'm Gil Gross. We've been learning about the Pilgrims from Nathaniel Philbrick. Even Native Americans who sided with the English, sided with the settlers, were imprisoned by them.
Oh, we think of, slavery as being, you know, from a different different time. But no, there was African slavery, but there was also native slavery in New England. And in fact, what was the way the English authorities dealt with it was, you know, you captured as many men, women, and children as possible. Those who were not killed were then shipped to the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, which were death traps. And, so you had, in the years after on the other side of the King Philip's War, there was the Sea Flower, not the Mayflower, the Sea Flower, a ship filled with Wampanoag prisoners that sailed south to the Caribbean to sell these prisoners, to get them out of New England. And this is not the legacy that I think most Americans look to when they think of the Mayflower.
There's another problem wrapping this up that this brings up, and that the Native Americans, of course, they start, you know, the long trail of tears that leads to their present diminishment in America from this. But even the Puritans become dependent on England to win the war for provisions and everything else. So the Puritans' hope for their own independence are also kind of dashed by this.
Oh yeah, it was a completely self-destructive conflict in many ways, because this would you're right. They relied on English help to survive the conflict. The standard of living in New England would take decades get back to the way it had been before King Philip's War. This was no victory for the English. This was the conflict that kind of destroyed the world that their parents had created on both sides. And so, I mean, to my mind, the story of Plymouth Plantation is ultimately a tragedy that foretells in so many ways what will happen in the United States as the country moves west, all the way ultimately to the Pacific.
And even Bradford, who we talked about earlier, when the Pilgrims first get here, eventually sees what became Massachusetts as a failure. He wanted this small religious community. He didn't want this big thing that was going to be controlled by England. And the founding fathers, such as John Adams, you know, and all the people who came out of New England later, probably would have frightened the hell out of him.
Yeah, I mean, this is the real poignancy of the story when it comes to William Bradford. This was someone who, you know, believed that they were doing this because the Lord told them to do it. And what they were trying to do was to recreate that sense of spiritual sustenance that had existed at first in England and then in Holland that had bound this group together. And that's what he wanted to sustain. But once they got to America and the population increased and their children wanted land of their own, they started to leave Plymouth Colony. And as that happened, Plymouth, as he says so sadly in his journal, would be like an abandoned mother. As the rest of Cape Cod, as the rest of what become Massachusetts became, you know, these thriving communities, the Plymouth, the beginning of it all, would be left kind of desolate. And so, for Bradford, it was personal. I mean, people he knew, like Winslow and Standish and all these people would move to other places where there was more land, where it was better for their children. And thus what ended what Bradford had hoped to create.
We have mentioned in the course of these discussions about the Pilgrims and Plymouth Colony, a lot of individuals. Individuals really matter. If the guy who tried to kill FDR and instead killed because of an errant shot, killed Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak, if he had been successful in killing FDR, the guy who would have had to lead us through World War II would have been an alcoholic vice president named John Nance Garner. That would have changed history.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think we all lead our lives, and we know that individuals matter. Yes, there are these great big social movements and things like that. But for me, they're contexts. They're not, I mean, what really makes a difference is what individuals do. And I think it's important that those stories that, you know, people in their quirks, in the good, the bad sides of them, that we look at them. We look at their characters, because I think, you know, that's the great lessons that history has for us.
Nat, thank you so much for spending the time with us. It's an amazing story, and I urge people to read the book Mayflower to get so much more detail.
Well, thank you, Gil. It's always great to talk with you.
Welcome back to the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross. Winter vacations are right around the corner and airline prices are rising. Hotels and rentals are getting booked for the holidays. We don't want you to be squeezed. So we turn to our friend and CBS News travel editor, Peter Greenberg. Peter, good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing just fine and, you know, bearing down for the holidays.
So let's start with something basic. People used to book travel with travel agents, and then with the internet, they moved to sites, you know, hotels.com, Travelocity, all of that, whole host of other, including sites that monitor all of those sites for deals. And then some airlines and hotels started saying, look, deal directly with us. We'll give you better deals than you see at the travel sites. And now I know people who are throwing up their hands and dealing with actual travel agents, which were considered a few years ago like rotary phones. So who should I be dealing with to book a vacation?
Well, I have news for you. The rotary phones are back bigger than ever because travel agents really proved their worth during COVID when they actually acted as advocates for their clients to get them their money back, among other things, and to get them rebooked. I'm a huge fan of the conversation. I don't mind researching fares online. I do it every day. But I always want a second or a third opinion from a human being who may have access to better inventory that's displayed online. I'll give you an example. How many times have you seen when you go online to make a reservation, either for a hotel or for an airline, only two rooms left, only one seat left? Most of the time, I have to tell you, it's a lie. Because what they're really telling you is there are only two rooms left in the allocation that this particular online travel agency was given by the travel provider, in that case, a hotel or an airline. It's not the total inventory. And so you panic, hit the keystroke, and end up paying more money for a seat that was much more than available than you thought.
Okay, so travel agents are like vinyl.
They are definitely back. And by the way, they can do something that the online folks can't. They can have a real conversation. They can answer questions like, can my kids stay free? Can you throw in free parking? Will you not charge me $9 for a bottle of water? And how much is the Wi-Fi? None of that comes up online. You know, you're just driven by the initial posted rate. And then you find out the ka-ching, ka-ching part later, which is not pleasant.
All right. Well, let's move on to something else that may not be something that calls attention to itself if you just go online, which is saving or at least making things easier through airline code share partners.
Ah, I will tell you a very funny story that just happened to us. I was researching a fare, a one-way fare from London to Los Angeles. We found one online. I did our research online. On British Airways, you want to guess how much it was?
Oh, I don't know, 900.
Okay, you're not going to the showcase showdown. It was $2,700.
Oh my gosh.
Out.
Ow.
But it's about to get better because British Airways is part of the One World Alliance that includes airlines like American and Finnair and Royal Jordanian and Iberia and many others. So what do? We went back online to see if any of those other airlines were posting a flight about the same time. Guess what? Iberia, the Spanish carrier, was flying from London to Los Angeles at the same time. Well, what was the fare? $770. That's almost a savings of $2,000. Well, guess what? It was the exact same plane, the exact same flight, the exact same coach seat, but it was a code share partner because how did that happen? When airlines code share, they're given different inventories, and depending on who books it, will determine the price they charge and how many people book it. So it's always a good idea to figure out who their code share partners are before you go for the first offer that you're given. In this case, we saved about $1,900.
Yeah, and that's an amazing amount. So let's go to where people are going. Are countries, for instance, with high inflation, good deals for the American dollar, or too many of those too unstable to take a chance on?
Well, you know what? If you take a look at the stability index around the world, even with the conflict in the Middle East, an overwhelming majority of countries are fine to go to and they're safe to go to. You just got to do your homework with State Department advisories. And I also recommend you listen to what the British Foreign Office tells their citizens about their advisories. And then do one more thing before you make the booking. Go online, find the English language newspaper printed in that country, and look at the last 2 weeks of issues. You'll get, you know, frontline, cutting edge information about what's really going on the local level. Then you make an informed decision. And once you do that, then the power of the US dollar kicks in, not to mention seasonality. So here we are with Thanksgiving coming up. You know what? Europe doesn't know from Thanksgiving. Africa doesn't know from Thanksgiving. Asia doesn't know from Thanksgiving. And South America doesn't know from Thanksgiving. Chances are even Antarctica doesn't know from Thanksgiving. Not just for Thanksgiving week, but for the week after, which in the travel industry is called the dead week. There are two dead weeks every year if you want great deals. One is the week immediately following Thanksgiving, which of course is when people are recovering from their dysfunctional family get-together. And the second dead week is the week immediately following New Year's when people are simply just recovering. And so if you can plan strategically, you're going to save a lot of money. If you want to go to Europe over Thanksgiving, we've seen fares as low as $500 round trip.
In those dead weeks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, there are places you've talked about, you know, checking news sources and things, and that's important because there are places. Well, I'll give you an example. My brother is married to a woman from Ecuador, and they had a little place down there too, which, because it didn't cost you much to have a little place down there. And they thought about retiring there and everything, because 3 years ago, Ecuador was like a little paradise. Now, drug gangs and things, not so much. And its reputation may not have anything to do with what's going on now. And you really have to beware of situations like that.
Exactly. And remember, the State Department has four levels of advisories. We're right now in a worldwide alert as a level two advisory. So let me run through them for you so you know. Level one advisory is quite simple. It just means travel with normal caution. I interpret that to mean try not to trip and fall. Level two, which is where we are now, is travel with increased caution. And with all seriousness here, what they're really saying is situational awareness. They're not telling you not to travel. They're just saying really be aware of where you are, what the situation is there, and, you know, things that's just to be looking out for. Level three is when people start digging a hole in their basement. That's called reconsidered travel. And level four, there are certain of them around right now. They're called do not travel. Now, remember, all of those four levels are simply advisories. They're not laws. They're not regulations. They're not restrictions. They're not rules. It's still your choice. But you want to make an informed choice. And of the 196 countries that are out there right now, there are only about four or five I wouldn't go to, only because I have no idea who's in control. Other than that, situational awareness, being smart, being commonsensical, the world is still your oyster.
All right. So what places are overlooked? And again, I go to my brother. He and his wife just spent a couple of weeks in Dubrovnik. They had a fabulous time. They loved everything about it. It's not a place that when you're talking about, you know, gee, where do you want to go on your bucket list and things people normally talk about? But they had a fabulous time. So what places are overlooked?
Well, actually, Dubrovnik most recently has been overcrowded. You know why? Deranged Game of Thrones fans. And you have to be very careful because when you're there, you're walking arm in arm with people you don't even know who are trying to recreate the scenes from that series. So be careful. But the real key here is be a contrarian traveler. Go in the off season. You're not going to Paris for a suntan. You're going to Paris to immerse yourself in the culture. So you don't have to be there in June and July and August with everybody else. Same thing applies to the other usual suspects like Italy and Spain. But then look at some of the other countries like Estonia, Slovenia, Lithuania. They're great at this time of the year. And of course, don't forget, if you really want to be seasonal, all the Christmas markets in Europe. And we're not just talking London and Paris. We're talking Central Europe and Vienna and all up and down the Danube River and in Germany. That's tremendous. And you do that when? The first 2 weeks in December, otherwise known as the Dead Weeks.
Thank you so much for all of your tips, all of your help, and you can go to petergreenberg.com for more.
You got it, guys. Much appreciated.
Welcome back to the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross. In this era of inflation, it would be nice to afford to entertain and still have money for presents, which are also part of this time of year. So how do we entertain on a budget and yet not seem cheap while still, well, you know, being cheap? Ivy Odom is senior lifestyle producer for Southern Living, where you can pick up lots of tips, lots of great recipes. Ivy, good to have you with us. And by the way, in keeping with the theme of the segment, Ivy's agreed to be interviewed without getting paid. So there you go.
That is the theme of the day, I think. Hi, Gil. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. So, all right, we're planning a holiday party. We don't want to go overboard. I mean, maybe we just usually don't. It's, you know, usually too much pressure and all of that. But especially now, let's face it, a lot of people are balancing many things right now. So when people are thinking about planning a holiday party, what should they be thinking about?
Yes, I know. I am guilty number one for having too many things going on. So, and it is doable. And holiday parties, I think they seem like they're such a big task, but they really are doable if you give yourself time to plan for them. You are less likely to spend money on the things that you actually don't need if you give yourself time to plan ahead for your parties. And I think whenever you're just initially thinking about your holiday parties from the get-go, think about a smaller gathering because you'll get a lot more bang for your buck that way.
Which is a very good idea. And let's underline that point you just made because it was a really good one. You don't want to shop last minute because that's when you end up trying to get everything at one store that may not have the best values. You may end up thinking, oh, if I had just been at, you know, the unnamed store because they didn't buy advertising time, where I could have gotten that for half price, I should have done it. You end up in kind of a panic and you do end up overspending.
Yes, you do. Planning ahead really is key. And honestly, you can never start planning ahead early enough. One of my favorite things to do, which is applicable kind of after the holiday season, is to take advantage of holiday sales to plan for next year. That's when things are going to be reduced for 50 to 75% off, and you can stock up if you have the room that is to store it in your house, but to get things for a really discounted rate to kind of plan ahead for next year.
Okay. You want people to be well fed. You've got a large number of people coming over. People now are very specific about what they say they can eat and cannot eat.
you do have to be prepared for it. And I am a Southerner, and Southerners, we know a thing or two about feeding a crowd, and we will never let a guest go home hungry, regardless of if they have a million dietary restrictions or none. So I really do think it is, you know, a gracious thing to do is to be aware of your guest dietary restrictions, but there are a lot of ways to get around it and still stay on a budget. You can have a grazing board. So we all love charcuterie boards, but whenever you start filling charcuterie boards with high-end meats and cheeses, it can become pretty pricey. So a cool way to kind of take up the real estate on a board is actually to fill it with some dips. Those are great ways to save money. People love a dip, especially during the holiday season, and you can make them ahead, which is a key to making your party hosting in general a lot more stress-free. Really, it's not about how much money it goes into it. It's all about the thought that counts. So plan ahead, and creating a warm and inviting atmosphere is what your party goers are going to remember the most. So just put some thought into it and it will go a long way, a lot further than money will, for sure.
Ivy Odom is senior lifestyle producer for Southern Living, where you can pick up lots of tips, lots of great recipes, and just generally have a fine, enjoyable experience, which you can bring over into your own life. Ivy, happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Gil. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
You're listening to the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.